Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on chemical dependency.
Good morning. Today we're going to be talking about monitoring aberrant behaviors. It's a follow-up to our topic last week on harm reduction. So it's part of the process of harm reduction. So first we'll start by defining aberrant behavior, and then we'll talk about aberrant behaviors being on a continuum and looking for patterns of aberrant behavior and how to respond compassionately when you're seeing those behaviors. And then I think some of you are already using the four A's, but we'll just review what's in the four A's. So from last week, this is the harm reduction model. So it starts out with a risk assessment and trying to determine if you're going to be working with a low, moderate, or high-risk patient and setting up some safeguards depending on what risk category they fall into. Then we're going to be monitoring their behaviors throughout the opioid trial with them, documenting any aberrant behaviors you see, addressing those, and then aggressively treating any comorbidities. Last week, I think I mentioned the Gourlay article, which is still really very helpful in terms of thinking about starting with patients and at least in an outpatient setting and prescribing opioids. So doing your typical pain assessment and assessing for substance and psychiatric risk, doing an informed consent and an opioid treatment agreement. Do you guys currently do informed consent and opioid agreements? Yeah. Sometimes they'll separate those out, like in the informed consent part of it, talk about the risk and benefits of pain medications, especially with potentially pregnant women, and for men, talk about like problems with low testosterone with chronic opioid use. And then the opioid treatment agreement kind of goes through things like, you know, only having one provider and using urine drug screens on a regular basis so that patients really understand what's necessary, how they can participate in their treatment, and at what point you might decide to taper opioids. So all that's kind of written up front. So usually you want to do a pre-assessment too, which is what's the status of the person's pain and what's their functional status before you get started with them on an opioid trial, so that you can monitor that over time. And at that first visit too, setting up some goals. So what are some reasonable goals for the patient with the trial? You're going to be assessing your 4As and doing some good documentation. We'll talk about some caveats to documentation based on aberrant behaviors that you might see. So prior to starting treatment, you want to know what are the patient's goals for treatment. So if you have patients that are saying, oh, I want to have zero pain, being able to talk with them about, you know, that may not be a goal that's achievable, but we may be able to get you out of bed at least a couple days a week, have you be a little bit more functional with the opioids. Do you need to enlist other consultants? If so, whom? That's really important to think about on the front end. So if you have a patient who has any history of substance abuse, maybe hasn't been in treatment previously, trying to connect them upfront with a provider so that they're co-managing with you. Or if you know that the patient has a history of depression or anxiety, maybe setting them up for some therapy in coordination with their pain management treatment. It's much easier to do that on the front end than it is to run into problems with the patient and their opioid use and then try to get them into some other co-management programs. So does what the patient requires exceed your resources? And if so, who or where is the best help available for the patient? And usually the social workers are pretty fabulous about helping to identify any kind of community resources that you may not have available. So we talked initially when you do your risk assessment about assigning to categories and that your strategy for management would be based on those categories that you'd assign a patient. So low-risk categories, you might engage just in routine treatment. So you have an agreement, urine drug test, the ORS, which is the Ohio Automated Prescription Reporting System. So if you're in another state, you'd be using, I think most states now have prescription reporting systems. So being sure to check that. We used to say every 6 months, but for your high-risk patients, you might check that more frequently, like every 2 or 3 months, checking that, and checking in on their substance abuse risk over time. For moderate risk, if possible, you might try to see them a bit more frequently because more can happen in a short period of time with someone who has a history of substance abuse or a significant mental health concern. So some would recommend even seeing them like twice a month, which I know may not be feasible in a lot of clinics, making sure they have appropriate psychiatric and addiction evals up front, and limiting some of the rapid onset pain medications with them. With high risk, if possible, ideally you would see them on a weekly basis and just give them a weekly script. You give someone who's really high risk and running into substance abuse problems, like say a month-long script, you may see that they run out of that, you know, after a couple of weeks just because they can't manage having that much medication all at once. So that's at least the recommendation, is to see them really frequently. Do some co-management from the start, limit the short-acting agents, and sometimes engage family members in administering the medications. Sometimes that can be a trap or a difficulty, too. You need to know what the family situation is. If you have other family members who are also at risk of abusing substances, that is just not going to work. So you need to know what's the family environment. And again, social workers or psychologists can help you in determining the safety of that environment. In terms of your follow-up, so say you've gone through the kind of opioid trial, Gourlay's procedures, this is your first follow-up visit, so you're going to want to assess what's their degree of pain relief, are they functioning better from a physical perspective, doing a little bit more, a little bit more active. What are their social and family relationships like? Are they engaging in a lot of fights about the medications? Or do they have family members who maybe aren't supportive of them taking their opioids, so they're not getting them dosed as you might have recommended for them? What's their mood and quality of life? Are they more irritable or more depressed or feeling more anxious? How are you progressing towards your goals? Are they meeting some of the goals that they set for themselves? And are there any medication misuse issues? So this would be kind of a snapshot of what you might want to assess at every visit. And our goal is to prevent harm via uncontrolled drug use, adverse effects, and increased pain. So in terms of the pain assessment and documentation tool, that's where you see those 4 A's. It's a tool that was developed by a psychologist that works in pain management, Steve Pasek. So the first A is analgesia, so I think that's pretty standard. So what was their average level of pain in the last week? What was their worst pain level in the last week? And you might, in terms of their worst pain, assess were there any triggers, anything that made their pain worse during that period? And are there any other things that they've tried that have made their pain better outside of the pain medication? What percentage of pain relief have they achieved? Like, where do they think they are in terms of achieving pain management goals? And is the relief making a difference? The second is the ADLs. So you want to know, for each of these areas, are they improved, about the same, or are they worse? So their sleep, family relationships, again, their mood, work, home responsibilities, recreation, and social life. A lot of times with addiction, you might see some problems, especially in family relationships. You might start to see more arguments with moods. You might see increased like mood lability or irritability. Definitely with sleep, depending on what kind of substance they're using. So sleep can be disrupted with alcohol, or say they start using cocaine, so they're just not getting sleep, and then they're crashing or having periods of depression. With someone with an addiction, if you're assessing what kind of recreational activities or hobbies do you have, a lot of times they won't have anything to report. You know, you ask them, what are you doing during the day to keep yourself active or busy? What are you interested in? Someone who's addicted will have very little to report on that front, not just because they're sick and not able to do things, but they just are so focused on getting medication that it's hard to think about anything else. And then adverse effects. So being sure, like, the number one adverse effect is constipation, so making sure that they have adequate management for constipation. But also, are they having any nausea or itching, mental cloudiness, fatigue or drowsiness? And from my understanding, initially when people are taking the pain medications, they might experience more mental cloudiness or drowsiness, but that tends to resolve. So making sure that they know that up front, because a lot of times they may discontinue the medication just because they're feeling drowsy and they're thinking that they're always going to feel drowsy on the medication. And then aberrant behaviors. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. In terms of defining aberrant behaviors, a simple definition is noncompliance with an agreed-upon treatment plan. So anything that's in your treatment agreement and they're kind of going off the rails, that would be considered an aberrant behavior. But really, a lot of studies that look at aberrant behaviors don't have a good standardized definition of what is an aberrant behavior other than that. And many studies just rely on aberrant UDT results. So either they have something in their system per their urinary drug screen that's not supposed to be there, or they don't have the drugs that are supposed to be there. But I'd like you to think about aberrant behaviors as much larger than just those two things. So you're going to be looking out for a variety of behaviors outside of that. This is the continuum of aberrant behaviors. We did a study years ago just with our team. I think like we had 10 people. And so these are similar to the rankings that they had for the aberrant behavior. We asked them to think about, what would you look at as something that's most indicative of a substance use problem or opioid misuse problem, versus what would you consider, well, it could be probable, but maybe not, and what would be like, this could be a variety of other things. So starting at the top, if you have evidence that someone is selling their prescriptions or diverting, that's like kind of a sign that, yeah, we need to stop prescribing. Injecting oral formulations, we've had that happen a few times in the hospital setting. Forging prescriptions, so anything at the top, you're going to see that once, and probably once and done. There's not too much more evidence that you would need in that case, that it's pretty unsafe to be prescribing. But as you get down the list, so involvement in car or other accidents or arrests. So if you see that once, that happens, but you're going to be looking more for a pattern of accidents or falls or other things going on. Family report of sale or diversion. I think we talked about that a little bit the last time. So that's hearsay, so we never know what's going on at home with the person, and sometimes they might be going through a divorce or a custody situation. The person that's calling in may not have their best interest in mind, so really being cautious to follow up carefully with that. Frequent lost scripts, not filling medications, and then, of course, requests for early refills. I am astounded at the number of times that we have had patients report that their dog has ate their medications or that it's fallen in the toilet. I'm so impressed with just how accurate, like, it is for pills to be, like, right above the commode and then just to fall, like, just right into the toilet. One person that said they had their dog eat their medication years ago, we had them bring in the bottles, and there were no, like, teeth marks or anything indicative of a dog having ate their medicine, no veterinary, like, report or anything. So, so there's all kinds of crazy things that happen like that. 40 to 45% of patients will have at least one aberrant behavior, but that seldom denotes the presence of addictive disease. So most often you're going to see aberrant behaviors on that lower end of the spectrum, just people having requests, you know, maybe requests for early refills. Most common reason for requests for early refills would be what? What would you guess? Yeah, increased pain or pseudo-addiction, so they're just not at the level where their pain is well-controlled. So that's the most common reason, and especially in the inpatient setting. Again, you might be called frequently to see someone that they have labeled as addicted, but really it's just, you know, they're prescribed a dosage that they're having end-of-dose failure, and once they have that addressed, their pain is much better and the behaviors resolve. So evaluate for pseudo-addiction. Know that the urine tox screens are not 100% accurate, so always do your due diligence to kind of follow up with the company who's doing the urine drug screens, just to run through what you're seeing with the patient's results before you confront or talk with the patient. And ideally, you would combine, like, your risk factor assessment from the beginning, the behavioral information that you're getting, and then the urine screen data, not just relying on one piece of information. So this is a patient sample of a patient that we had seen years ago. So 32-year-old Caucasian female seen in an outpatient palliative medicine clinic after being treated for breast cancer. She had platinum-based neuropathy. She missed 3 psychotherapy appointments, but continued to attend her palliative or pain management appointments. And she was continuing to complain of increased anxiety. She's been seen in the emergency department 4 times in the past 3 months, usually at the end of her prescription or when her prescription was running out. And her mother noted that she was increasingly irritable at home. So what are some things you see in there that would be considered potentially aberrant? Yeah, so in terms of the aberrant behaviors that you're seeing here, so you're having multiple early refills, you're seeing like missed appointments and continued complaints of anxiety despite missing those appointments. Also, emergency department visits with this particular patient, we discovered that in total, I think over the course of 3 or 4 months, she had had 11 visits. So these were just the ones that were recorded in our system. So, what would you do in this case? How would you approach this situation? Yeah, so you want to check if she's having adequate analgesia. So the hypothesis there is maybe she's the pain is not being managed well, so she's just using more of her medication to get her through to the end of the month. Yeah. What else might you do?
It's important to talk to her about it, mm-hmm. and get her perspective. She may come out and say that. Opinions, it's gotten worse, and you explain, or she might be evasive, so you can get a lot out of just the one-on-one interview with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could do that, or you could bring the mom in too with her in the same appointment so that the stories are kind of on the same page with that. I think too, with the missed psychotherapy appointments, you know, you could just reinforce attending those and be cautious not to reinforce with benzodiazepines, you know, that she really needs to be attending those appointments if she's feeling more anxious. So there's a lot of different ways you could approach that situation, and we'll talk at the end about how we ended up managing that. What we have to be careful about is the writing reflex. We'll talk more about this when we cover motivational interviewing. The writing reflex is very strong in most of us that go into like the healthcare profession because we really want to help people, and we learn a lot of great things, so we really want to correct and help people with the things we're learning. But the writing reflex is the reflex we have to correct someone or something, to offer advice or to correct whatever is going wrong with a person. Directing someone to do something, like if we're saying, I think you need to go to substance abuse treatment, you know, just pointing that out can create a psychological reactance, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the next slide. But as the person starts to argue their position, they may become more committed to that position. As I hear myself talk, I learn what I believe. So, but in motivational interviewing, we want to inhibit that. And we talk about that as steering into the skid. So when the patient is saying, no, 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 we don't want to argue, yes, 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 you need to go and do this. Like, we kind of want to steer into the skid with them. I hear you saying you really don't want to do that. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that is? You know, when you're driving in the winter and your car starts to go off, like skid off to the right side of the road, your tendency is going to want to be to shift the car to the left, but that can wreak more havoc, so you want to try to steer gently into that skid in a controlled fashion, and that's exactly what you want to do with a patient that's starting to argue with you. Psychological reactance is really with any kind of behavior change, and substance abuse treatment is a huge behavior change that requires an acknowledgement that things aren't going well here. And then along with that acknowledgement, a lot of times for people, they have to acknowledge, I've just screwed up a lot of my family relationships, I've stolen things, I've lost my job. So there's a lot that goes into accepting that this really is a problem. So ambivalence is a natural component of that change. So their lack of motivation, if we think of it as lack of motivation, the tendency is to be more frustrated or angry with patients versus just thinking of it as unresolved ambivalence. There are other things right now that are more important to them. And they're usually not stuck because they don't appreciate the downside of their situation. So they know that they've maybe screwed things up on multiple levels, so us pointing that out is probably not going to be helpful. So instead of getting the person to telling them what to do, saying you need to go to substance abuse treatment, we really want to elicit from them what they're seeing as a potential problem and get them to talk about what are some potential solutions, what have they thought about. And when we talk about motivational interviewing, we'll talk about some more strategies to do that. But just really kind of being confrontational really doesn't do much but create reactance in a patient. So rather than that, we advocate using compassionate responding. So these are some different ways that you can respond compassionately. So whenever we see an aberrant behavior, verifying that it's accurate to the extent possible, trying not to assume anything. So even if you've read multiple times in the chart that this person is addicted, taking time to really assess what's going on. Using open-ended questions, I've seen some physicians say, so you're just taking more medication because you're feeling more pain, right? And so, yes, that's exactly right. That's what's happening. So asking, I noticed that at the end of every month, you're going to the emergency department. Tell me a little bit more about what's happening with that, what's going on there. Or your mom is saying you're feeling more irritable. What's your take on that? What's happening there? So probing and being persistent. So if somebody is going off track, not answering your question, just bringing them back and rephrasing the question. Trying to confront in a non-judgmental manner, that a lot of people run into problems with their medications. It's our goal to try to understand what's going on here and get you the help that you may need in order to manage your medications more safely. Let them know you're there to help. And be observant. There are a lot of really great books on malingering and behaviors to look out for. So if you're in this business for a long time, and especially if you're going to be working in a outpatient or inpatient setting prescribing opioids, it's probably a good idea to check out some resources on malingering, just so you know what kind of behaviors to look for. Some easy things are avoidance of eye contact. You're having a great conversation, person's making really wonderful eye contact, you ask them a question about an aberrant behavior, and all of a sudden they're looking at the ground, or their eyes are kind of shifting, they're no longer making eye contact. Long pauses, so it seems as if they're trying to develop a story or stories with inconsistent details. They may start to fidget, or definitely if there's hostile gestures. One of our physicians in talking to a patient about some aberrancies with his medication use, like grabbed his pencil and almost like stabbed him in the leg. So that was a clue that, yeah, there's something not right here. So since then, be very careful about if you're doing this discussion with patients to keep your, you know, keep a good distance from them, stay close to the door so that you're able to exit. Don't ever let the patient block your access to leaving the room. And then seek professional guidance. So if you're really on the fence about what's going on, be sure to talk to some of your other colleagues and get some additional input about how to manage the aberrant behavior. I think we talked about this the last time. Try to avoid labeling. So if you're not sure if it's an addiction, please don't put that in the chart, because that follows someone around everywhere. It's better for, like, say, a psychiatrist or psychologist to put in like the fact that they may meet criteria for this disorder rather than to have a suspicion or hypothesis about that. We talked about the 4 A's, so definitely documenting your 4 A's, and every time it's helpful to kind of go back to your previous notes and any aberrant behaviors that you saw in previous notes, just bring them forward because you're really starting to look for a pattern of aberrant behaviors and you may forget some of the things that happened previously. So this is another example. So a 46-year-old male with sarcoma status post a right shoulder replacement. He had significant pain that was managed well with methadone. He missed his last appointment due to a court date related to divorce, and the office gets a call that the patient is selling his medications. His UDTs have been consistent with prescribed medications, but a few months ago, his UDT was positive for an unprescribed benzodiazepine. He admits to trying his sister's medication to help cope with a divorce in that case. So what's your approach? What do you do in this situation? First, what aberrant behaviors are we seeing here? Yeah, so the missed appointment, the unprescribed benzo, the call from the family, which are you most concerned about of these behaviors? Mm-hmm. Yeah, potentially the unprescribed benzo, but definitely if he's selling medications, you want to figure that figure that one out right away, not let things linger with that. What about documentation? What do you document in this situation? Somebody calls up and says, hey, I think this person's selling their medications.
I would avoid documenting it in the chart until you've verified it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could document that there are concerns, but with it being hearsay, I think that putting it in the durable medical chart is difficult.
Yeah, so she's saying that in terms of documentation, that she would document just that there have been concerns expressed, but maybe not document the specifics of that concern until you had addressed it with the patient. Does everybody agree with that, or would you do something different? Yeah, so
as much as information as possible.
Yeah, so another approach would be to document, be more specific, but then indicate in the note that it's really not been verified and at this point it's hearsay. Yeah, so you could go either way, but definitely making the point that this hasn't been confirmed, we're not certain that this is the truth of the matter. And then, yeah, definitely when you are able to bring the patient in, documenting that discussion and what their response was. Also, it's helpful if somebody's calling in to make sure you have their name and phone number available, and asking them if it's okay if when you meet with the patient you contact them and have that discussion. Try to have that discussion together if the patient is willing to do that. So those are a couple different approaches that you can take with that. What else might you do in this particular case? Like, how are you going to manage this situation?
Short script with an early follow-up, getting her in drug screen at this visit.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it on this, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you said a short script, like getting her in sooner, like more regular follow-up. Yeah, those are great ideas, too. And you may even consider like a random urine drug screen if you have the capacity to do that. Because, if you're seeing the person every month and the urines have been clean other than this one thing, they may just be taking their medications right before they come in, depending on what it is with methadone. They would have to be a little bit more savvy about when they're taking it for it to build up in their system. But yeah, you might have them come in at an unexpected time and do a urine drug screen just to make sure they're taking it. Some clinics, I don't know about our clinic, but some clinics do pill counts. They have a pharmacist who can also do pill counts. So in the middle of their prescription, have them come in and verify how many medications they have left or pills they have left. But I think in this case, the ideal would be to get the person in as soon as possible, have the discussion just to make sure that we're prescribing safely and get them potentially tapered off the medication if you're feeling it's unsafe. So in summary, so aberrant behaviors are always on a continuum. There are some behaviors that you'll say, yeah, this is just not acceptable. It's not safe for me or it's not safe for the patient, so we need to do something more immediately. But it's really important otherwise to monitor the pattern of aberrant behaviors, address them directly, respond compassionately, and document conservatively. With the other case that with the woman who had the emergency department visits, we ended up meeting with her as a team, like with her and her mother. She had agreed to have our mother there. And so based on our discussion and our concern, she actually started crying, was really tearful, and said, I'm really having trouble managing these. I think part of it is anxiety, but I'm taking the medications to manage the anxiety. And so we were able to eventually do a full wean with her and do some more to treat her anxiety. And she had been having some problems at work, and we were able to help her to resolve those. So, but I think it was, in that case, like a kind of compassionate team approach. We were more, not so much like, look, this has to stop. You're going to the emergency department, like a couple times a month, two or three times. Just bringing her in, and we really need to understand what's going on here. We're really concerned for your safety and well-being. You've like beat the cancer, and you're in a good spot, so we want to support you. And I think that support has really created that kind of ambivalence for her and had her open up and get the treatment that she needed. Yeah, so any thoughts, questions, concerns about aberrant behaviors? Or? Okay, great. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.